Hello, and welcome to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wherry, Associate Editor for McLean's Magazine.
Every election, we are inundated with public opinion polls, but recently it seems the numbers that have been pumped out ahead of a vote are way off. We speak with political author and former pollster Paul Adams about what's wrong and how polling firms can firm up their figures.
It's been rare in recent memory, but all parties have voted in favor of a motion in the House of Commons. This aimed at setting up a national strategy on end-of-life care. The author of the motion, NDP MP Charlie Angus, is here to talk about it.
And did you know Stephen Harper nearly stepped down as Prime Minister and the Conservatives once had a Liberal mole? The details are in a book called 14 Days, written by Bruce Carson. He's a former advisor to the PM who is now facing charges of influence peddling and illegal lobbying. He joins us to discuss his legal troubles and the revelations in his new book. For your politics, for your power, welcome to The Hill. Whenever an election is called, political polling kicks into high gear. Firms call up Canadians to gauge their opinions on questions like, who will you vote for, which issues matter most, and who would make the best premier or prime minister?
Polls used to be a fairly accurate way to determine what would happen in an election, but recently it seems like the numbers have been off. The best examples are from a few provincial elections over the last couple of years. In Ontario, very few predicted such a big Liberal majority over the Progressive Conservatives. In BC, the Liberals held on to power despite all signs pointing to an orange wave from the NDP, and in Alberta, the Wild Rose Party didn't come close to taking power, leaving the PCs to keep governing despite what the headlines said.
So what's been going wrong with these polls lately, and how do we get the figures back on track? To try and answer those questions, I'm joined now by Paul Adams, a former pollster who is now a political author and teaches at Carleton University in Ottawa. As I just mentioned in the intro, the polls in the elections of Ontario, BC, and Alberta have been really off compared to what the actual election result was. So what's wrong here?
Well, I think different things have been happening in each of those elections, possibly. I mean, we can never know for sure, but it seems like what happened in Alberta was that you had a late shift, fairly decisive shift to the Conservatives in the last few days that most of the pollsters didn't catch. There was one pollster that came out very close to Election Day and came closest to getting the result right, but it looks like there was a late shift, and that's a problem that's happened frequently in recent years, and it's because Canadians don't pay as much attention to politics and as they used to. And sometimes they change their minds at the last minute. The problem in BC was quite a different one, I think. It was that the people who turned out to vote turned out to be somewhat different in their inclinations or intentions than the people who were answering pollsters' questions. So it seems like it may have been an issue of a failure to predict the turnout. In Ontario, I think it's another issue again. Really, the polls weren't as bad as people seem to think. If you look at the aggregators, those are the people who average all the different published polls, what you see is that almost all the aggregators said that it was going to be a Liberal government. Most of them thought it was going to be a minority. But they, generally speaking, got the result right, short of what the Liberals actually got. I mean, there was another issue, though, I think, in Ontario, which was that there was a kind of a confusion generated by pollsters putting out both their direct polling numbers, what people were telling them about their voting intentions, and then also adding in numbers of what they said were likely voters. In other words, they were trying to adjust for turnout, and those likely voter models were actually worse than the direct numbers, and that really confused people, especially because you had a couple of big organizations, ECOS and Ipsos, saying absolutely the opposite about what likely voters would do. In other words, the Ipsos said that it was going to ensure a conservative win, and ECOS said that they were going to be disproportionately Liberal. So you really have a whole bunch of different explanations, but if you wanted to put it very simply, it's that Canadians are less fixed in their political views than they used to be. They're probably less fixed than Americans are. They're more unpredictable. They're more volatile. We've got lots of different parties, and you have people turn out in different proportions from an election to election, so they're just harder to predict.
Is it all just the unpredictability of the voters, or should the pollsters and the polling firms maybe be looking at their methodology or samples just to make sure that they are getting it right or more accurate than what we've seen recently? I mean, how do they deal with that?
Well, I think you've put your finger on something, which is that we're in a period of great experimentation with methodology. It used to be that all the pollsters basically polled the same way. They used they had live interviewers phoning us on our home phones, and that actually still seems to be the best method, especially if you add in cell phones. But it's also the most expensive method, and what's happened is that there are two new ways of polling people, and one is the what some people call robocalling, that is to say it's not a live operator but a computer that phones you and you punch in your answers on your keypad of your phone, and the other is online polling. And so what happens is you often have two or three of these methodologies operating in the same election, and they don't always suggest the same outcome. In the Ontario election, the online polls seem to suggest a stronger result for the Conservatives, and the various kinds of phone polls seem to suggest a stronger result for the Liberals. And so it's very confusing to the public, because how are ordinary folks, voters, trying to figure out what they're going to do and maybe making strategic choices, how are they supposed to figure out which one of these polls is accurate and is a good guide to their behavior?
And does that sort of come back to your first point that, you know, maybe people who are willing to pick up the phone and answer these questions are maybe already decided and they know where they want to go, while people sitting on a computer may not even head to the polls in the end?
Well, I'm not sure whether it's the case that particularly online respondents are less likely to vote so much as that you just really have different profiles of people. I think people who answer polls online are likely to be younger and more connected, more urban, all those sorts of things. And there are ways for pollsters to balance that out, but they're not completely effective. The other issue that I think you alluded to is just fewer and fewer of us pick up the phone and answer those questions. When I was first doing polling with the CBC back in the, I guess, 1980s and 90s, we used to get 75 or 80% of people would answer the phone and answer a questionnaire. You're now getting below 20% for most polls and as low as 1 or 2% for some of these robocall polls. So the response rates are very low, and that's obviously a problem.
On that note, have telemarketers just caused a nightmare for pollsters, because now it seems you can't go a day, well, I mean, after the do not call list, it's helped quite a bit, but if you're not on that list, you don't go a day without getting a phone call from somebody claiming that you've won a cruise or something like that.
Right. Well, I mean, I think lots of people don't, you know, they screen their calls or they don't, you know, they rely on the answering machine nowadays. I know in my house, my wife says she never gets polled. And I get polled several times a year, and the reason is because I pick up the phone, and because if somebody starts asking me questions, I answer them. So so that means that people like my wife are less likely to get polled than people like me who are interested in having that conversation.
Are there separate results, like two tiers of polling, some that maybe the political parties would see and some that we see in the headlines? Like, are there differences in the quality of results that maybe a party might invest in as opposed to a media outlet, which may either be getting a free poll service out of an agreement with a polling firm,
right,
or maybe paying for that poll and We all know media outlets don't have the same kind of cash that they used to have.
Right.
So do we, I mean, did political parties see this coming? Like, did Hudak know that his PCs were toast, or Adrian Dix's New Democrats know ahead of time that the headlines were simply wrong about where they were going in BC?
Well, certainly parties poll in a different way. They are less interested in the sort of provincial or national result, in the sort of broad brush stuff. They're much more interested in they're polling much more intensively in key swing ridings where they think they're close to winning or close to losing, and they're also much more likely to be testing different arguments, different messages, different ways of logic, different aspects to their leader, those kinds of things. So they often have a better read on how the election is going to come out, even if they don't necessarily have a better read on the broad brush percentages. My understanding is that the Liberals' internal polling showed that they were going to win a majority, even though really it was only ECOS among the public pollsters, the media pollsters, that was suggesting that. I think that I don't really know what the Conservatives and the NDP polls were saying, but you know, sometimes party pollsters can get it wrong too. There's famously Romney's pollsters in the last presidential election against Obama thought that he was going to win, and they were making sort of miscalculations about who was likely to vote. So yes, they have very different kinds of information. It's often more granular, more specific. They're spending money where it pays. The media tends nowadays to take a lot of freebies, and some of that stuff is junk. And you notice that particularly a lot of these by-election polls that are so wildly wrong, I hope the Toronto Star isn't paying for that stuff because it's worthless or pretty close to it.
In case you're just joining us, this is McLean's on the Hill. I am Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio. I'm joined on the phone by Paul Adams. He is a political author and former pollster with ECOS Research. We are discussing the recent problems that we've been seeing with political polling in Canada and the numbers pretty much being way off. Now, Paul, earlier in the interview, you do acknowledge that there are problems with the unpredictability of voters nowadays through an election campaign, and challenges for polling firms who haven't been able to shift methodology well enough to deal with our changing society. But you also just mentioned in your last answer the media and our role. Now, we know a lot of media outlets do have financial issues, especially newspapers. And when it comes to polling, a lot of these polling firms are offering free services in deals with media outlets to be like the exclusive pollster. And during these economic times, I think we can all agree it's an attractive offer. I know some observers, though, do blame the media for what they call cheap headlines or reporting on this. Should everyone share some of the blame here? I mean, from headline writers to polling firms to make sure that they get the numbers right, and maybe even the people taking in this content to realize the context in all of this.
Well, I think the number one thing that the media could do would be to contextualize numbers better when they report them. If you're going to report, for example, forums polls on the by-elections, as the Toronto Star repeatedly does, and other outlets do, in fairness, too, you should say that they've had a bad record, right? You should say that they've blown election after election and that they haven't shown themselves to be very reliable. But in the Ontario election, for example, if you're reporting, as CTV did, the Ipsos poll, because they're your pollster, you should put it in context, saying Ipsos is different from many of the other pollsters, that the message they're saying, the story they're telling is different, and that the average of pollsters is different. And the same thing should be true, you know, reporting ECOS polls, is say, you know, this is what they're saying, but there are other pollsters saying different things. I think if what happens is that whether media pay for a poll or they get it exclusively for first release, they tend to treat it as if it was the well of all wisdom. They treat it as if it was the only information out there. And what they should be saying is, here's some information. It's interesting, but it should be seen in the context of other information, which isn't exactly the same, and allow readers and voters to try to make sense of it themselves and give them the full information to do that. Instead, what their tendency is to do is to say, we've got this new poll, look at this, pay attention to it, pay attention to how it's different from everything else, isn't this interesting? They make it into a bigger story than it is, and in the course of doing that, they cheat the reader or the viewer who would be better off with some, with information that was better contextualized.
But is this really anything new, though? I mean, polling has been a very important part of the political process and the narrative of an election for decades. And, I mean, as long as this has been going on, we've seen headlines being torqued towards the angles that that people want to read about.
That's essentially true. And I think that when the media used to invest a lot of money and pay for polls, they were they obviously had some considerable interest in making it sound as if this was exclusive and special information that nobody else had. And that was always a problem. And now you have these media organizations getting freebies or near freebies from polling organizations, and they continue to do the same thing. But it was wrong before, and it's still wrong. And really, what we're having is with this more volatile electorate that changes its mind more quickly, plus a confusing array of methodologies, that we have a more complex and difficult picture than we used to have, and the need for context is even greater, and yet we're not getting any more.
So I guess the big question is, how do we fix all of this? I know you've touched on this throughout the interview, but you know, given the problems pollsters seem to be facing, given the issues that you've identified, given the unpredictability of the electorate, I mean, are we doomed to have inaccurate polling for a very long time to come? Or is there a way to address all of these issues, to bring it all together and solve this problem so that we get the numbers right?
Well, I think that there needs to be a lot more humility on the part of the pollsters. They shouldn't be saying, well, my numbers are different from everybody else's, but the, damn it, they're right, and ignore everybody else. They should be more humble in the face of uncertainty. And I think that what we saw was a kind of, gunslinger mentality in this Ontario election, which was confusing to people. And it was not, you know, ultimately pollsters are or should be social scientists. And their approach was not at all like that. There was a lot of braggadocio that was inappropriate given the confusing picture the polls were presenting in aggregate. So I think that the pollsters need to be more modest about the meaning of their results, and that's hard for them to do. News outlets need to be much more careful about the quality of the polls that they're reporting on and give context. It's not that hard when you're reporting an Ipsos poll, for example, in this election, and the Ipsos polls and the narrative they presented turned out to be quite wrong and quite different from what other pollsters were saying. It's not that hard for CTV or another organization to say, this is what Ipsos says. It runs contrary to what many of the other pollsters are saying, and it's different from what the aggregate of polls is saying. You know, you don't have to say that Ipsos is right or wrong. Just give us the context so that we understand that it's different. And that will help people understand the landscape and the degree of uncertainty better than the way in which we present them to them now.
So I guess my last question would be on the fact that we're not too far away from a federal election. And, you know, given a lot of the problems that you've identified throughout this interview, do you think there's going to be a lot of inner reflection from polling firms in the lead up to the 2015 vote, you know, whether it be the unpredictable electorate or, you know, the methodology that is being used by each firm? Do you think we're going to see a lot of changes in the polling industry in the lead up to the 2015 vote?
Well, I think the industry is constantly looking at its problems and trying to avoid repeating them. And I think actually all these likely voter models we saw here was in Ontario, which was turned out not to work out very well, but it was an attempt to address the problems that had shown up in BC. So there was an attempt to correct past errors, but all I can tell you is in 30 years or so of watching this and participating as a journalist and as a pollster and now as an academic, I've seen these cycles of angst from media and pollsters again and again and again, and yet I see the same problems repeating in the admittedly changing landscape. But the fundamental problems of pollsters overstating their results and of media failing to contextualize them, those are problems that go back 10, 20, 30, 40 years, and they seem to persist, and there's no reason why they have to. It just means pollsters taking a more social scientific attitude and journalists, frankly, doing their job, which is to contextualize. They do it in other areas, and they just seem to ignore it in this one because they treat it as if it's a scoop, and it's not a scoop. It's a little bit of incremental information that needs to be put in the context of everything else that's known.
That was political author and former pollster Paul Adams speaking about the challenges around political polling in Canada.
Coming up on the show, how the issue of palliative care has united federal parties, and a former advisor to the Prime Minister reveals Stephen Harper came close to quitting and the Conservatives once had a Liberal mold.
Welcome back to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wherry, Associate Editor for McLean's Magazine.
Still to come on the show, we speak with a former advisor to Prime Minister Stephen Harper about his book 14 Days and the revelation that the PM nearly quit not long after taking office. But first,
it's not often Tories, New Democrats and Liberals vote in unison in the House, but they all agreed this spring to back a motion calling on the government to establish a pan-Canadian palliative care strategy. The idea is to improve care at the end of life for people across the country. NDP MP Charlie Angus tabled the motion, and McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes caught up with him in the foyer of the House of Commons to talk about it.
What prompted you to take on that issue?
Palliative care is something I think has been, it touches every Canadian, it touches every family, and it's something you just assume is there until you need it and it's not there. I began to realize that there were major gaps across the country in terms of palliative and end-of-life care. You go into certain parts of the country and there's really good programs in place. There's a coherent integrated strategy. And others, you end up dealing with fragmented pieces. And when you deal with the fragments, families fall through the cracks. And it can be very traumatic, not just for the person who's suffering, but for the whole emotional and psychological dynamic of a family if those pieces are not in place.
Did you have an idea that there was sort of a common sense of the urgency of the issue in all parties in this before you tabled the motion?
I think what really made this motion succeed is that there's out in the general community, outside the so-called Ottawa bubble, there is a real awareness of the need to address palliative and end-of-life issues. We had enormous support from the medical community from the beginning, from the frontline workers, the personal support workers, the nurses' associations, also individual Canadians, and the various faith communities for whom this is a very important issue. They did a lot of the heavy lifting of calling MPs' offices, of saying, put the partisanship aside, come together and for once do something in Parliament that will actually send a message to Canadians that we do listen to what people out in the real world expect us to do with.
There is, a difference in opinion among MPs of different parties on how much of a lead role Ottawa should take in general on health care and social issues related to health care. What do you think the federal government's role should be? What would the policy response be?
I think when we were beginning to move the palliative care motion, I certainly was getting a sense that within the government this was something they were a little uncomfortable with because the Stephen Harper government doesn't believe there's a federal role in health care. As New Democrats, we fundamentally disagree with that. The role that the federal government can play in terms of a national palliative care strategy is not to deliver the services. Certainly the provinces and the territories are much better equipped. It's not also to dictate, but to say we really need to look across the country. If Regina has a system that's really working and another city doesn't, how can we actually learn so that the provinces can deliver better health care? This isn't about throwing more money into the system. The money's already there. It's being spent. But where it's being spent in fragmented areas, we're not getting the results, even though probably we're spending more money with people ending up in eMERGE, people having to call ambulances in the middle of the night, the attempt to find bed for a dying loved one. That money is already being spent in the system. And then you look at where the systems are integrated, and it's actually costing the system a lot less money, and we're getting much better outcomes.
There's been some interest because of Stephen Fletcher's private member's bill and the question of doctor-assisted suicide, people having a right to sort of end their lives when they want to. I know that's an extremely fraught issue. But when we've held town halls with the Canadian Medical Association on this at McLean's, we found that people actually link the two issues quite a lot, and that the sense that there isn't sufficient palliative care, hospice care, it gets tied up in people's sense of whether they want that power to end their lives. Do you see the two issues as being connected?
I was really impressed talking with the Canadian Medical Association how clear they were that there was a need to deal with the issue of palliative care. I find it very troubling to expect politicians to wade into something as fraught as the issue of euthanasia and doctor-assisted suicide. I know within our caucus we had an excellent evening of discussion. We have medical doctors, nurses, legal minds, and we couldn't even agree on what the terms were. So these are really, really, really complicated issues when the common sense solution is staring us in the face. What the medical community is saying, what the people who deal with the sick and the dying are, is that let's deal with the 99% who need palliative care. The other issues of the 1%, those complex issues, those can be discussed. But you can't discuss that in a vacuum. And right now, with the lack of palliative support, we certainly have a vacuum in Canada.
This is starting to feel to me like one of these issues, like the way depression was at one point, or even gay marriage, where people start out uncomfortable talking about it. There's even a taboo book talking about it. And then surprisingly quickly, it seems to me at least, surprisingly quickly, people get over that. And as soon as some people start talking about polygamy, everybody feels more comfortable, you know, airing views, even on something this freighted with emotion and religious issues, personal morality issues.
What really struck me when I started this discussion is everyone has a story. Everyone has a good experience or a really traumatic experience. So I've been finding when we've been holding our public forums, as a politician, I'm used to the back and forth, but you end up seeing the incredible profundity that exists in average people who've wrestled with this, and they look to government and say, where are you? Do the right thing here. And so this may be a moment where we get this conversation, and it is a conversation. Maybe this conversation will help us take this issue further.
That's McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes speaking with NDP MP Charlie Angus about his motion calling for a national strategy on palliative care. If you're looking for more on this topic, McLean's.ca has extensive coverage of end-of-life issues.
Coming up, a former advisor to the Prime Minister tells us how the PM nearly quit and how a Liberal mole tried to help the Conservative Party. Welcome back to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wherry, Associate Editor for McLean's Magazine.
Bruce Carson, a one-time advisor to Prime Minister Stephen Harper, has been busy, and it's not entirely a good thing. He's facing charges of influence peddling and illegal lobbying, but he's also found time to write a book.
It's called 14 Days and gives us a firsthand look at the conservative movement from the fall of Kim Campbell in 1993 to Carson's departure from the Prime Minister's office in 2008. Carson had previous convictions for fraud, and he was disbarred by the Law Society of Upper Canada. But when Harper and his conservatives took power in 2006, Carson was hired as a senior advisor.
Since leaving the PMO, Carson has faced allegations of influence peddling for his work trying to bring water filtration systems to First Nations, and he's been charged with additional counts of influence peddling and illegal lobbying for his work with energy organizations. I'm joined now on the phone by Bruce Carson. Bruce, before we get to the revelations made in your book, let's talk about those charges. The opposition is actually using your legal troubles as an attack on the Prime Minister and his judgment. How does it feel to know that you're the reason for attacks on a Prime Minister that you once advised?
It's unfortunate, but it is what it is. No one has ever questioned my ability to give advice and the advice that I've given. One would have hoped that especially the NDP would have some sympathy with somebody trying to dig themselves out of a hole and come back and do a decent job advising.
Now we'll turn our attention to the book where you look at 14 key events in the conservative movement starting back in 1993, but I'm going to jump to the 2006 election. You reveal the conservatives had a mole in the Liberal Party. Tell me about that, and who was this mole?
Well, it's unfortunate that the knowledge of that died with Doug Finlay, our really great, unbelievably good campaign manager. It's one of those things that just came out of the blue. Doug called me up and said, I've got this situation where we're going to get the Liberal platform before it's publicly released. I've got a guy in the Liberal war room. So Doug went ahead and I came back from Montreal after the debates and got the platform in my hands and set to work a group that evening. And unfortunately, I guess for us, there wasn't much in the platform. I don't know who it was, and I don't know anything more about it than when I wrote it in the book, than what I wrote in the book. But it was an interesting phenomenon at that time.
Now, you also reveal in this book that Prime Minister Stephen Harper nearly stepped down over the Chuck Cadman affair and claims that he knew about the offer of an insurance policy to Mr. Cadman. Why don't you take me inside the room when that conversation was happening, when the Prime Minister was considering what to do?
So we went down to a 24 Sussex and Ian revealed what was going on, and this book had come out, and there was an allegation that a bribe had been offered to Chuck Cadman. When we walked in, the Prime Minister was quite concerned about this and quite concerned that if there was going to be an RCMP investigation, he might have to step aside for the time of that investigation. And We quickly disabused him of that idea that Cretchen and perhaps others had stayed on, and there was no reason at all to step aside because of an investigation that may or may not happen, and get over that, and let's just deal with the problem we have at hand.
Did he argue back with you about this? Was this a long conversation, or
no,
did he take
it? No, it was very short. It was. Like, I think it was a minute and a half, and that was it. There was no, like, it was, I was adamant, I think Ian was, Sandra would have been, if I just can't remember the sequence of events around that, but it was a very quick conversation. There was no point in even contemplating stepping aside when others faced with more serious issues had carried on. So we went about the task of putting together a defense.
Now, you not only look at previous issues within the conservative movement, but current issues within the conservative movement as well. You talk about the Senate scandal, and you say in your book that it's harmed Harper's credibility and his reputation for integrity as an effective manager of the country's business. Do you think that through the scandal, with what happened with Mike Duffy, and more specifically how that case was handled, and the check written by his chief of staff at the time, Nigel Wright, $90,000 check, has the prime minister or his government turned their backs on the ethical standards that everyone had rode to power on back in 2006?
I don't think so. I think that what could have been done better was the management of that issue. I think that usually when you're trying to manage an issue like this, and we had plenty when I was there, you try to get all the facts as bad as they are, as smelly as they are, and put them out with your particular view of them. And it seemed that that just wasn't able, that wasn't either wasn't done or they couldn't do it.
You said that in the government that you were a part of, when you were an advisor, that in the Ian Brody PMO, the Harper would have known almost immediately about anything untoward, any bad actions or activities by a senator or things going on within his government. Is it plausible then to believe that the prime minister would not have known about a deal like this in his own office, a $90,000 check cut?
Yes, I think it is. It is quite plausible.
Is it plausible deniability? Just like,
no,
I don't want to know what happens?
No, I think it's just a different management style. Like, I don't cast any aspersions on the prime minister. I think he just didn't know. And if he says he didn't know, he didn't know. It's too much of a gamble to say I didn't know when he actually did know. It's just, you wouldn't do that, and he wouldn't do that.
Now, let's look at a different scandal that's happened with the prime minister more recently with the Supreme Court. He made an appointment of Justice Nadon, and Nadon was found by the Supreme Court to be ineligible. And since then, we've had this sort of war of words where the government seems to be implying that the Chief Justice, Beverly McLaughlin, did something improper by giving them a shout to let them know that Mr. Nadon would not be eligible. First off, on this issue, would you have advised the prime minister to make the Nadon appointment?
The issue is, I think Cormac, is whether you take any chance at all. And if you're completely risk adverse, like I am, and maybe not in my personal life, unfortunately, but completely risk adverse, which I would be in which I think we were in government, is you don't go ahead.
So you would have advised against this?
If I had been there, I would have, yeah.
So the Supreme Court decided that Mark Nadon was ineligible, and for the time being, or for a moment of time, it seemed like that was it. It was done, it was dealt with, and everybody was moving on. And then we had this leak, so to say, of allegations that the Chief Justice had been lobbying against Mark Nadon. And since then, both the Justice Minister and Prime Minister have been implying that Chief Justice Beverly McLaughlin had did something inappropriate by calling to raise the issue of Nadon's ineligibility. So what do you make of that? Why do that?
Well, that makes no sense to me, quite frankly. I have yet to hear any plausible explanation for it. There may be some strategic reason down the road that one is not aware of, but at this point, it doesn't make any sense.
Since you began writing this book, have you heard from anybody from the Prime Minister's office or the Prime Minister himself?
No, not at all. Somebody said last night, I don't think I'm on that Christmas card list.
On that fact, though, there have been many people who have sort of been shunned by the party once controversy arises. And when news first broke about your issues on the water filtration systems, the prime minister has sort of shunned you. Do you feel abandoned by the party and the prime minister in the office that you once basically devoted your life to?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. We're all over 21 in this situation. I was very, very lucky to have the job that I had for the time that I had it. And, I will always look back on that period as the best period in my work life. Depending on, of course, what comes in the future. But, I'm not 21 anymore, but it was certainly the best period that you possibly have working with Ian, working with Sky Journal, working with others, and working with the Prime Minister. So I feel just darn fortunate to have had that opportunity. The situation that I found myself in now is what it is, and I don't think I've been able to do other things and with my life, and if they don't want to talk to me, that's okay with me.
In your book, you look back at 14 days that made the conservative movement. So I want you to take a look at a 15th day in 2015 on election day. What do you think is going to happen?
You know, this isn't being partisan. I don't think that Mulcair has been able to convince Canadians that he's moved that party to the middle. And I think we all await what Mr. Trudeau is going to do with regard to the economy. So I think that the 2015 election, when it comes to jobs and the economy, I think that's playing to the Prime Minister's strength. There's quite a good possibility the government will get reelected. Whether it gets reelected with a majority or minority, that's another question.
On the opposition front, do you see a shift?
I think that's in the cards. I think it's, not that I'm any expert on NDP politics or Liberal politics, but I think it's going to be hard for Mr. Trudeau to leap from third to first. But I think there's certainly a leap that could be made to second. The issue around Mr. Mulcair is does he have the Jack Layton appeal that appealed to Quebec voters in 2011? I think that's doubtful, but God knows, I'm sure he'll try. I think that Trudeau has certainly the ability and the people around him to certainly move from third to second.
That was Bruce Carson, a former advisor to Prime Minister Stephen Harper and author of the book 14 Days, Making the Conservative Movement in Canada.
That's it for this week's episode.
For more of your politics and power, join us next week on The Hill.